Hello, everyone. Welcome to our podcast. Calliope Awards for 2014 were presented on Wednesday, April 23rd. The name Calliope means beautiful voiced, like the muse, the inspiration of eloquence and poetry. A calliope is a musical instrument, a steam organ, the type used in a carousel. And it's a species of hummingbird. Finally, Calliope is the student journal of art and literature, published every spring at Northern Virginia Community College, Annandale. It is a collaboration of the Departments of English and Liberal Arts under sponsorship of the Division of Languages and Literature. We are bringing you the presentations of remarkable, talented people. We hope you will be inspired. Here they are, winners in the category of fiction. Second prize, Troy Christopher Holmes, The Fighting Cocker Spaniels.
The Fighting Cocker Spaniels by Troy Holmes. The political season at Richard M. Elementary has drawn to a close with much excitement, and I've emerged victorious. It all started about a month ago when our teacher came up with a new class project. It was almost as cool as our last project when we got to pick our class mascot. We chose the Fighting Cocker Spaniels. We named our school after Nixon's beloved dog, Checkers. We all had a lot of fun with the project, and this new project was going to be just as awesome. Our teacher decided to hold a class election to see who the class president of our third grade was going to be. She wanted to teach us how re-elections worked and how fun politics could be. She wasn't wrong. It was totally fun. However, it was a hard-fought victory, and I give most of my credit to my daddy, who taught me everything I know about politics. First of all, he gave me a sweet political name. My name is Clinton Carter, and politics are my game. With a name like that, how can I not be class president? Also, right before I decided to run for class president, me and Daddy watched all of season one of House of Cards on Netflix. Francis Underwood is my hero, and I will serve my time in office with his teachings at my disposal. Now I know what everyone's thinking. How the heck did I pull it off? Especially, how did I do it with the great field of boys and girls running? Well, I tell you, it didn't come easy. I had to really work hard for it. For example, let's look at Billy Wilder. He was out of the gates faster than any one of us. I thought he was going to be my biggest competition. After his speech about his homework to recess ratio and how he's going to implement that strategy, I thought I was done for. I mean, he was promising that for every hour of homework that is assigned during school, the teacher is required to give 30 minutes of recess to go along with it. Shoot, I would even vote for him. But then all hell broke loose with the cooties controversy. Little Billy didn't stand a chance. A photograph emerged the next day in all the funny papers in our school newsletter. Billy was caught in the act. He was caught in the act of holding hands with the first grader. Now, don't even get me started with little Billy having a relationship with a younger girl, but that's besides the point. We all know first graders have cooties. How can we trust a boy that lets cooties into our school? We can't, and little Billy was forced to bow out of the race. This brings me to my next victim, Timmy Markson. Now, Timmy was out of his league from the get-go. He did so poorly during the debates that he didn't have a chance. During the entire debate, Timmy was playing Angry Birds on his phone. He didn't even look up to answer the questions. I mean, he was given softballs from the moderator. One of his questions was, do you think dinosaurs are cool? I mean, how do you not answer yes to that? Everyone thinks that dinosaurs are cool. I wish I would have got that question. I would have knocked it out of the park. Instead, he said that dinosaurs were last year's fad and nobody likes them anymore. Angry Birds messed it up for Timmy. Why does that game have to be so gosh darn fun? Oh well, I won't miss him. I will miss Susie though. It's a shame what happened to her. She was a great candidate and the smartest girl in class. She gets straight A's in every quiz we've ever had, and I have no idea how she does it. She dominates in the classroom and then kicks all of our butts in kickball during recess. Susie has it all. Then the unthinkable happened. It turns out best-in-class Susie was cheating on her vocab quiz all along. This scandal sent shockwaves through our school, and Susie got detention for a week straight. She swears she didn't do it, but the answer guide was found in her backpack. She was caught red-handed. With her serving time, she was forced to bow out of the race as well. What a shame. Maybe she can change her image and run next year for vice president. The game of politics at Nixon Elementary is cutthroat and not meant for the faint of heart. With a scandal in everyone's mind, we need a little comic relief in the race. Thank goodness Doug ran and gave that to us. I don't even know why Doug even ran for office. Maybe he won it on his middle school applications, or maybe his mommy made him run. He didn't get picked. He did get picked last time and every single time in kickball. I even feel sorry for the kid. He seems like a good kid, just a little off. His allergies didn't help either. It's kind of hard to go to table by table during lunch to try to get votes when you're allergic to peanuts and you're lactose intolerant. He can only go to the no peanut tables and wasn't allowed to kick back and have a milk with his future constituents. It's important to the voter to feel at one with a candidate, and when you can't even have a milk with a boy, it's hard to get a vote. With all those candidates out of the way, it was down to just two. It was me, Clinton Carter, against Amy Smith. The battle of the decade, as everyone was calling it, and it was proving to be a tough battle. Amy was solid on the girls' vote. She was crucial in the band and orchestra vote as well, as she played multiple instruments. She played the clarinet and violin and is extremely talented in both. Lucky for me, I was able to secure the foreign students' vote as I'm able to speak a little Spanish. Thank goodness my nanny speaks Spanish, or else the Latino kids would probably have gone with the pretty girl Amy. Also, I was able to keep the jock vote as my arm and legs do the talking for me. I'm best in class in dodgeball and kickball, and I am either always a captain or the first one picked. My skills on the field alone, I think, give me the upper hand. Then the third debate happened. It was the last debate in the contractually obligated agreed third debate and was in a town hall format. The debate was held right before nap time as we all sat down and discussed the issues our school was facing. I was knocking all the questions out of the park as my stance on homework, recess, and the all-important stance on cutters in the lunch line were solid. I was even bold enough to put my foot down on in-class marriages. I told the students that if our class bunny and our class turtle really loved each other, then who am I to say that they can't get married? I was also fearful that most students would think that my stance was too strong and that I should have left the issue to after the election, but I couldn't do it. I had to say what I felt, and I was glad I did because everyone loved it, and soon after the debate, a formal marriage between Michelangelo and Hoppers was planned. We were pretty even in the debate until it was Amy's turn. It seemed like a simple question, but the wording of the question is what messed her up. All she had to say was what people believe and do in their own homes is their own business. But she didn't say that, and she decided to tell people what she really thought. And in front of the entire school, she said she still believes in Santa. I mean, come on, Santa. We're in the third grade. We can't believe in Santa anymore. That's for little kids. Amy showed the voters who she really is, and that's someone who believes in Santa. I mean, we all love presents, and do I know for sure that Santa doesn't exist? No, I don't. And no one really knows for certain, but you can't say it out loud. Everyone will make fun of you, and that's exactly what everyone did. They laughed her right out of the classroom, and for the next couple of days, she called in sick to school. She was officially done, and I was officially the new class president of the Great Fighting Cocker Spaniels. Like I said earlier, it wasn't easy to win the presidency. It was a lot of hard work. Do you think all those scandals happen out of the blue? Just like I saw on television, I had to fix the situation. Did I take the cooties picture and send it to the funny papers? Did I give a student all of my Halloween candy to ask Amy if she still believed in Santa? Did I rig the vocabulary quiz and place the answer guide in Susie's backpack, sending her up to fail? Did I buy Timmy the new Angry Birds and install it on his phone? Politics is not a game you can play clean. As we say here at Richard M. Elementary School, show me the proof and I will answer those questions.
First prize, Hannah Glazer, A Lesson Learned.
Do you know where you are, Wicket? A harsh voice growled at Paul, waking him from his drunken stupor. A moment passed before he managed to gather his wits as well as his broken recollections of the night before. Yes, sir, he finally managed to mumble back. Do you remember why you're here? Sheriff paused as he inhaled a draft from his hand-rolled cigarette. He breathed and then dropped his hand, still clutching the smoking fuse, back down to his knee, where he rested his palms as he squatted face to face with Paul from behind the bars. Wicket. The uneasiness in Paul's gut spread quickly as a pair of blue eyes smiled back at him coquettishly in the back of his mind, beckoning him back to the night before. He groaned impulsively and covered his own eyes with a hand that reeked of spilled gin and faintly the tantalizing yet damning scent of a flowery perfume. Sure you do, Wicket, Sheriff smiled, an icy grin stretched taut beneath his furiously squinting eyes. He watched Paul a moment longer before adding forebodingly, sure you do. Paul slid his forefinger down and peeked through the gap. Sheriff was standing, unlocking the door. He bravely ventured to detach another finger from his forehead, then another and another, until finally the whole hand was removed by sheer force of will. He waited until Sheriff had walked slowly with his long, heavy stride back to his desk before beginning his first attempt to stand. Over the course of 2.5 minutes, muscle by muscle, Paul Wickett joined him at his desk, cowering in fear in the straight-backed wooden chair set aside for visitors. Sheriff waited patiently, squashing the remnants of his charred cigarette in the ashtray he kept by his elbow like a child torturing an insect before preparing another. By the time Paul had quivered to his seat, he had the fresh cigarette poised between his lips. He struck a match. Paul watched the flame shiver as Sheriff drew it closer and closer to his mouth and gulped. Sheriff easily pulled in a satisfying lungful of smoke and held it there, trapped for the moment within his deep chest. He exhaled the stinging vapor in Paul's direction, his watchful, steely gaze never once faltering from the target. "Wicket," he finally began, "did you ever hear about what happened to the last individual who laid a hand on my daughter?" "No, sir." The barely audible sound of a mouse busily chewing a hole in the corner of the room nearly drowned him out. "Of course you didn't." Sheriff leaned back in his chair and grinned. "No one did." Paul systematically unwound his vocal cords from around his spine. "That's so?" he squeaked. "Indeed it is." Just over Sheriff's shoulder through the uncurtained window, Paul could see the sun twinkling brightly in the sky, beaming over the cheerful sight of a sleepy Main Street on Sunday morning. He hungrily gazed at the white clouds that blossomed and roamed so freely in the expanse, and the empty street just out of reach that led away past the painted shop fronts toward a horizon of tall Sierra mountains jutting infinitely upwards. At the sound of a small click by Sheriff's seated waist, his heart clattered into his boots. He tried hard to focus on the idyllic image presented him by the window, fixing his eyes fast on the far-off peaks. He heard Sheriff place something heavy on the top of the desk with a thud, something metallic and mechanical, but he couldn't bring himself to look down until he was sternly instructed to do so. When he did, he could have sworn he felt the nails being driven into the lid of his coffin. There, inches away, enveloped in the gloom of Sheriff's shadow, lay a gun. "There we go, Wicket, that's better. Now, let me tell you about this here revolver of mine." Sheriff reverently lifted the device with one hand and squinted down the barrel as he aimed it at the oblivious mouse in the corner. "I can't tell you how much I love this gun. Colt 1851 Navy, 36 caliber, light as a feather, leaves a hole so neat and pretty, you need a doctor just to tell you you'd even been shot." He smiled to himself the way a father would to his child, placing the terrible beauty back onto the desk with eyes full of admiration. Some folks nowadays might look down on an old ball and cap style firearm like this, but me, oh no. You ask me, nothing tops this beauty for sheer elegance and reliability. Paul's soul was long gone by now, and he clung for dear life to the window that teased him so cruelly with the promise of a world outside. He didn't hear Sheriff's voice anymore, only the pulsing of the blood in his ears and the rhythmic chewing of an industrial mouse somewhere miles away. Sheriff went on. "But as much as I love this here Navy of mine, sometimes I'll admit she doesn't exactly pack the wallop I need. Now in those cases," he reached into the drawer on the opposite side of the desk and drew out a second, heftier handgun and placed it next to its sibling in front of Paul. "Do you know what this one is called, Wicket?" He didn't bother waiting for a reply, knowing that his words had been addressed to the abandoned shell of a man. "This here is a Smith & Wesson Model 3 Schofield revolver, 45 caliber. Ooh, let me tell you, you wouldn't want to see the chunk of a man this old friend of mine can carve out." Paul's eyes were glazed, staring off into the space beyond. He dreamed of his misspent youth and all the Sundays he now wished he'd spent praying in church rather than learning to do the things that would land him here. "Now, I'm not sure exactly what it would take to stop a bullet as big as he's loaded with from putting half a man's insides on his outside. I don't think a Rocky Canyon wall would be enough to hide behind." Sheriff leaned forward, his eyes digging into Paul's despite their detached, averted gaze. "I don't think the entire earth would be enough to hide behind." Paul continued to stare out the window. Sheriff was undeterred. "Now let's say I had some qualms with some villainous individual. How do you propose I should go about dealing with that individual?" He took the Colt up again and inspected it playfully. "Well, it depends on a few things. See, I choose this here gun to get my point made without causing an uproar. I point and I aim, and with this fella, I never miss. This here's the gun I use on a man that I respect. Wouldn't feel a thing. But my Schofield, oh now." He swapped pistols, oblivious to the world around him as he found himself caught in reverie. "This cannon I keep loaded for the kind of scum I don't think deserves the luxury of one neat little hole. I saved this gun for the man I want to send to the devil in a bucket and a hat box." Paul began to grow very still. Sheriff observed this with satisfaction, placed the gun down, and went on gravely driving his point home. "I saved this gun for the kind of man I catch touching my daughter. Do you understand me, Wicket? Wicket?" Silence was the only reply. Sheriff was disappointed. He'd gone too far, he'd broken him. He lingered, pausing with his hands on his knees. He leaned over the two powerful tools of destruction displayed on his desk, scrutinizing his victim, waiting for the satisfying signs of a man scared straight to manifest. Paul's face at first remained blank. Then in a flash, his eyes still fixed on the window regained their focus. Before Sheriff could so much as gasp, Paul had leapt up, slapped the cold onto the floor, grasped the Schofield, raised it, pointed it towards him. "Wicket, no!" Sheriff screamed as a barrel exploded, shattering the glass in the window. To this day, if you ever ask Paul Wicket what happens next, he'll tell you that there are three things he swears on the Bible to be true. First of all, he hadn't a clue who the man with the rifle outside of the window had been, and secondly, he insists he staunchly refused every dollar of the reward, only relenting when the town insisted he do so. And finally, he'll say with a smile, "The chicken and dumplings I had for dinner that evening at Sheriff's house that night, what Sheriff's daughter said was the most delicious meal that I have ever eaten in my entire life. Still, it wasn't half so good as what I had for dessert."
Next are winners in the category of poetry. Second prize, Jessica Myers, Metempsychosis.
Metempsychosis. She sits in her wheelchair, gazing out the window. She has the ability to move, but not the will. Still, she sits and whispers. She's been in this asylum for ages, a person that nobody knows. She was forced into thraldom by this existence, while she witnessed him exit his. Abyss, filled with chaos at first, but now this chasm is filled with only emptiness. Still, she sits and whispers. She's enclosed by this flesh, but liberated in remission. She gets lost in reverie, enthralled by her memories, or maybe they are her lives in other dimensions. Ascensions, the quintessence of her infinite samsara. Still, she sits and whispers. She is in these places more than in this particular reality, and she knows this institution is her corporal existence because she can sense it when she surrenders to it. Still, she sits and whispers. She dreams in her memories that she's back at the asylum, and she knows it's not a dream at all, but it is her reality. Still, she sits and whispers. All is lost, and this place appears so gray. A dwelling without him holds no sanctuary. Still, she sits and whispers. She refuses to reside here. Instead, she drifts from her reality to a place where she's with him everlastingly. He is perpetual. It's consistently him, never another. The souls are the same, but the gender, the guise, the species, it's those characteristics that change. Still, she sits and whispers. They are companions, lovers, or enemies. They may not find each other during every lifetime, and they may have other companions, lovers, or enemies. But we only have one true soulmate, each other. Still, I sit and whisper. I whisper the last words I said to you, the only ones that have escaped these lips since I witnessed Jivatma, your beautiful soul, slowly seeping out of your temporal embodiment. Still, I sit and whisper. I whisper these esoteric words, these words which allow me to travel to you time and time again. Our hearts, our souls, they are intertwined and are forever. Very still, I sit and whisper. Thank you.
First prize, Angelica Gascon, Onions.
Onions, a dream that lingers within my thinnest veins, underneath the layers of this transparent skin. She stared at her half-naked self in front of the mirror while I stood at the alcove watching. I followed her as she slipped out to the balcony holding an onion and a knife. She sliced the onion in half, placed the other half and the knife on the corbel. She scraped a slice of onion from the nape of her neck down to the side of her waist. In an instant, there she was, thin fingers laced around my neck. Fright took sounds of pounding fists against the gateway of her greed. My body lay like giant stone on seabed, trapped in the void of her imperishable discontent.
The Calliope Committee is grateful to so many people at Nova Annandale, staff, faculty, and students for their generous support and creativity. Robert Brown of Nova's Web Services and Digital Media served as technical editor of this podcast. Nova, we are partners in your success. For Calliope, I'm Shirley Noon.